Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Defense attorney Anthony Cotton has spent his professional career working for the underdog and the voiceless. He's advocated for those accused of first-degree homicide, distribution of heroin and cocaine, burglary, robbery, including banks. He's even achieved not guilty verdicts for clients who have confessed to crimes. Joining us is Anthony Cotton. And Anthony, you went to what, Catholic Memorial?
Yep, Catholic Memorial High School.
You went to UW-Madison.
Yep.
Went to Marquette.
Yep.
Did you always want to be an attorney?
No. My mom and stepdad, my stepdad's now deceased, but he and my mom both were lawyers. And he actually was one who pushed me more to become a lawyer than anybody. When I grew up, I didn't really think I'd go in that. I actually sort of thought maybe I'd go into politics. It was something I was always interested in. And I was a political science major in college. And then when I was nearing the end of my college studies, my stepdad was telling me, go to law school, go to law school. And back then, you actually had paper applications. So I remember he came and picked up my application from Marquette, drove it in, talked to the admissions office, and literally the next week, they told me that I had been accepted. That's how I went to Marquette.
That was kind of a nice stand.
Yeah, it was great for him to do that. Yeah, it was, in retrospect, it was wonderful. At the time, I wasn't even enthusiastic about it, but it turned out to be a good career.
Yeah, I said that you always have stood up for the underdog and the voiceless in your career. Were you always like that as a kid?
Yes, 100%. From the earliest memories I have, I've always felt an incredible degree of empathy towards people that are picked on and less fortunate. I went to Catholic schools my whole life out in Waukesha, basically. And, you know, I was never the most popular kid. I was never the part of the popular crowd. I was just somebody who marched to the beat of my own drummer, but I always have felt an extraordinary degree of empathy towards people that are picked on. And I think that translates nicely to what I do for a living.
You know, I think something that's interesting about you, and I don't think I've ever heard you talk about it, is in law school, one of your professors hired you to do human rights work in East Africa, of all places. How did all that come about?
That was a crazy experience. I mean, of course, I was broke at the time and in a lot of debt for, you know, paying for law school. And I had an international law professor, Andrea Schneider, who I loved international law. And I asked her, were there any opportunities to go work overseas? She had a Yale law professor colleague who worked with the Eritrean government in East Africa. So Professor Schneider said, hey, I have an opportunity for you to go to East Africa. You're going to investigate war crimes and human rights abuses. And you have to figure out a way to fund it because it's an unpaid, essentially a volunteer experience, if you will. So I was able to get a grant for back then $2,500, which covered my airfare. I think it left me with about $1,000, if I remember correctly, for the summer. I converted it to Eritrean Naqfa, which was their currency, and lived there that summer and traveled around the country investigating war crimes.
What did you find?
Well, I had a driver and a translator and at times a security guard, and we would go into villages and interview people who had been victimized by the Ethiopian army. So people who had lost their homes, lost their cattle, lost their sorghum, which is a wheat-based crop. So we just interviewed people and we took photographs and we prepared reports for an international tribunal.
You were how old at the time?
23 or 24.
How did this influence you going forward with your law career?
It had a profound impact on me. I've been saying a lot lately that a lot of times we do what's called downward comparison and we also do upward comparison. I looked at people who were in Eritrea who didn't have running water, who didn't have stable food, who didn't have schools, didn't have medical care. And I thought to myself, like, okay, it's easy to look upward and say, well, I don't have as much money as A, B, and C or this person, or I don't have this whatever. I would do downward comparison and look at the people there and think to myself, like, how on earth did I get dealt? You know, one of my best friends always said that he wants to win the lottery. He said it from as far back as I can remember. And I'd always say to him, like, we won the lottery. You were born in America. You have a Catholic school education. By virtue of being born here, you won the world's lottery. And that's really the takeaway I took from that whole experience was how incredibly fortunate we are here.
In addition to that, you worked for what, a federal defender's office while still in law school?
Yeah, and that was a very, very big opportunity.
There was a landmark case that you were involved in. How did all that come about?
I always say that the best things happen in life by saying yes. I mean, of course, that shouldn't be the default rule for everything, but I tend to take on a lot and say yes to more things than I probably should. And I was working in the federal defender's office. They had the biggest case. One could argue it's one of the biggest federal criminal decisions in United States history because the case was called Booker and it struck down mandatory sentencing guidelines in federal court. And it just so happened this office I worked in was arguing it at that time. They were the lawyers of anybody in the country who had this case. I asked them if I could go to Washington, D.C. to help them prep the arguments. I mean, of course, I'm just a law student, but I wanted to help however I could. They said, yes, you can come to Washington, D.C. You can sit in on the oral arguments. I got to sit in the Supreme Court and be next to the justices' clerks as I watched it. And I got to prep the lawyers for it.
This is really heady work for a law school student.
Yeah.
I mean, did you realize the significance of what you were doing at the time?
No. I mean, I knew I was involved in something big because it was a Supreme Court, but I don't think I spent much time reflecting on the significance of anything I was doing. I was hungry for opportunities to make a difference in the world, and I said yes to a lot of things.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I was really trying to build a reputation, make clients happy, impress the judges, and show prosecutors that I knew what I was doing.
Defense attorney Anthony Cotton talks about his first case out of law school, defending the man who attacked Mayor Tom Varik outside of the state fairgrounds.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with defense attorney Anthony Cotton. All right, so you graduated from law school. Then what?
20 years ago, I can't even believe that. Oh, 20 years went by. I started out with a very, very low salary working for my mom and stepdad. I was salaried at $35,000 a year, 2005, which, to put it in perspective, I was making more money driving garbage truck on Saturdays than I was making as a new lawyer those first 2 years.
And what did you do? I mean, what were your tasks then?
My tasks were help my mom and stepdad with whatever projects they needed help with, but our firm didn't have clients really hiring us back then. We were a general practice firm taking divorces, lawsuits, criminal cases. We didn't really have a defining identity at that time. So I was more of a support attorney. I started taking cases from the public defender's office. Whenever they had any extra cases that they wanted to give away, I would always say yes and take these cases. So I was being thrown into the mix on some very random cases, including when the mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett, was attacked outside State Fair. It was a very brutal thing that happened back then. I was right out of law school. The public defender's office appointed me to defend that attacker.
How did you approach that?
It was the first time I had press in my face. I mean, every time I came out of court, there was cameras, there was newspaper reporters. Of course, we didn't have the social media stuff that we have now and some of that nastiness, but I learned how to interview with reporters. I learned how to be careful with what I said, and I learned how to handle the glare of the spotlight.
I mean, that had to be a really difficult case because you had a popular mayor.
Yep.
The attack on him seemed so unwarranted at the time. Did you have second thoughts about defending?
No, maybe a little bit. I mean, that was the first time that I took on a case where it had a life of its own, where I wasn't just dealing with the courtroom dynamics. I was also having to deal with all those side issues, the press, the publicity, having a high-profile victim. So there were times where I thought to myself, maybe I bit off more than I could chew, but I think I got my client through it okay.
So after that case, did you kind of have an inkling that you wanted to represent defendants?
Yeah, I think that very early on I realized, how often I was getting abused because I was a really young, I'm 25 years old, I look like I'm 20, I don't really know anything, I have no real world experience, I'm still going out on the weekends with my friends till 1 a.m. on Water Street, I'm not married, I don't have kids, so I'm just I have a law degree, but you come to court and it's easy and everybody has more experience than you. And so the judges treat you poorly, they don't know who you are, your clients treat you poorly because you don't even know what you're talking about half the time. And you're having to spend so much time. I felt like I had to spend a lot of time trying to make sure people didn't fire me because what do I know about anything? I'm representing a guy who's 40 years old and I'm 15 years younger and I have no real world experience. So I was really trying to build a reputation, make clients happy, impress the judges, and show prosecutors that I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You said that you had grown up going to Catholic schools and you were somewhat sheltered.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, I would say yes and no. I mean, my dad owned a garbage company. So from the age of 10 or 11, I always worked at my dad's garbage company, which was the epitome of a blue-collar, nasty environment at times. The language, the racist jokes you'd hear, the weird dynamic between customers and my dad at that time had a really short fuse with people. I mean, so it was, I would say that prevented me from being sheltered because I was exposed to blue-collar roofers, laborers, guys who did construction on a daily basis.
After the case with Barrett, did you find that you only wanted to defend criminals? Or were you just open to anything at that point?
I knew that I only wanted to do criminal defense. I didn't want to do lawsuits or divorces or anything like that.
Why?
For me, it was an easy decision because criminal defense is the only career where I felt like I was really, truly helping the underdog on a daily basis. I like the idea of having the odds stacked against me. I like the idea of putting up a fight for people who don't have the ability to do it on their own. I also find it interesting to have and thrilling to have a human being that I'm trying to walk through a problem. Like I get to know their families. I get to know the client. And I don't think I could do other areas of law where you don't have that really close client interaction.
Was your goal always to get your client acquitted?
My goal is to always do what is realistic for the client and in their best interest and consistent with what they set as the objective. So that's like a terrible answer.
But what does that mean?
What it means is like you meet with the client, you go over the evidence, and there are a fair number of cases where an acquittal isn't going to happen. The evidence is just there. It's the majority of people who are arrested are not innocent of their crimes. So you're figuring out, okay, how strong is the case? Is this one where we can go to trial and win, or is it one where we're going to get a plea deal? And I found as the years went by that evidence tended to get stronger as we had recorded statements, recorded confessions, body cam, squad video. There's more concrete hard evidence, DNA, to sort of show what happened. And so in that universe, you're not always approaching a case with the goal of an acquittal. Oftentimes, it's going to be a negotiation.
But in your case, you've managed to get a lot of people with that kind of evidence, including people who have admitted to crimes.
Correct, yep.
And confessed,
yep.
Or been identified in lineups, yep. And in court. You've managed to get acquittals for them.
Yeah, and I don't know, honestly, in my core, how many of those people were innocent or weren't innocent. I mean, I can remember one case in particular that you're mentioning where a client of mine in Waukesha had pleaded guilty to burglary. He had been convicted of burglary. He had confessed to burglaring his neighbor's home. And we had stolen $1,000+ of coins from a 5-gallon jug and wheeled it out of the house, told the police he did it, pled guilty. He fired his lawyer. I was a young, young lawyer. I got appointed by the judge. I thought it was crazy for this guy to withdraw his guilty plea, but he insisted to me that he didn't commit this crime and that he had been covering for his adult son who had the same name. As we did our investigation, it made all the sense in the world, and I realized that that's exactly what the dad had done. He had taken the rap for the son, didn't realize the penalties. He thought, I'll pay back the money. They won't punish me. So he soon realized he was going to go to prison for a number of years. He had become estranged from his son. His son continued to use drugs. And so the dad decided, I'm not going to be the enabler here, protecting him yet again by confessing to something he did. We went to trial. We told that story to the jury, and they found him not guilty.
How surprised were you hearing those words, not guilty, in a case like
that? I still remember being in Africa thinking to myself, okay, when I come back, will I ever have a not guilty verdict if I go into criminal defense? And then my first trial I ever had, I got a not guilty verdict. And then plenty of them continued from that point forward, and I realized that it's hard, but it's achievable if you work towards it.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
She said, yes, that's the guy. She said, I'll never forget him. He was substantially taller than me. I remember looking up at him as he was stealing my purse.
Defense attorney Anthony Cotton talks about getting a not guilty plea for a man who was accused of attacking nuns.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with defense attorney Anthony Cotton. Another case that I find fascinating that you managed to get a not guilty for your client is somebody who was accused of what? Battering nuns?
Well, the nuns, yeah, the Brooks case. Yeah.
What was that?
Another absolutely bizarre case that I don't know how it fell in my lap, but without getting too much in the weeds, it basically involved a client who was accused of assaulting nuns, breaking into a convent. And of course, I grew up in the Catholic Church, going to church twice a week. And after this assault on the nuns, allegedly, he goes running from the convent, gets in a car. The car drives a block ahead. It collides with another vehicle in an intersection, and he goes running from the car. The police catch him a few blocks away. He doesn't have any purses or anything on him. The purses are in the vehicle. And the cops follow the footprints in the snow from the car to the defendant, and the nuns had identified him. The only reason we won that case, there's one big reason, was nuns are very honest witnesses. They don't lie. And it's human nature, believe it or not, when a witness is in court and they say to the witness, you know, oftentimes a witness has never seen the defendant before, maybe one time if they were robbed, right? So 9 times out of 10, I have an African-American client sitting next to me and a witness on the stand who's oftentimes a white person who they say, do you see the suspect or the perpetrator anywhere in court? And the witness looks, they're not going to pick someone in the gallery. They always pick the person sitting next to me every time, whether that person did it or not. In this case, the nun did that. She said, yes, that's the guy. She said, I'll never forget him. He was substantially taller than me. I remember looking up at him as he was stealing my purse. My client was 5'3". The nun happened to be 6'1". I couldn't believe it as I was hearing it. There's no way this guy committed that crime. And it turned out the owner of the vehicle that fled was 6'3", 6'4", a really tall guy. I think what happened is my client was the passenger in the car, didn't go into the convent. Driver of the car got away and escaped. They didn't find him. And I think he's the one who committed that crime. And I think that's why the jury said not guilty.
How do you feel as an attorney when you know you've got him in a case like that?
Good. It's a good feeling to prevail and do good work for your client.
How do you contain yourself in that moment?
After that case, I cried. I walked outside the safety building and I remember sitting on the ledge out there and I cried for probably 10 minutes because I thought to myself, like, this is exactly how the American criminal justice system is supposed to work. Like, I still get emotional thinking about it. It's whether he did that crime or not, I don't know. He says he didn't, but the system worked as it should. That was an all-white jury. All white people evaluating the guilt or innocence of a black man who had numerous prior convictions, had been dealt a terrible hand in life, but the evidence did not prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that bedrock principle is so important in our justice system, and I felt like the jury truly embraced it in that case.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
My initial impression was that Morgan had profound mental health needs that needed to be addressed very quickly.
Defense attorney Anthony Cotton talks about representing Morgan Geiser and the day they first met.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is defense attorney Anthony Cotton. You have represented some very high-profile clients. And I want to ask you about some of these. And I know there's only so much you can say about certain cases. But obviously, the one that's in the news right now is Morgan Geiser. How did you first meet her? What were the circumstances?
That was fascinating because her parents, her father's now deceased, but her mom and dad had called me within hours of her arrest. And I am born and raised in Waukesha. It was, I think, a Saturday I was at the office. And I got a phone call from the mom. She said, my daughter's been arrested. We believe she assaulted someone. That's all we know. They didn't know any other details. I'm sure I said to her, I recall saying that your daughter is a juvenile. She's 12. She'll be released. They don't keep juveniles in custody for very long. And then we can bring her into the office to have a discussion. I found out within hours of that it was much more significant, that it was nearly a homicide case, and she was not released from custody. Her bail was eventually set at, I think, $500,000 or $1 million, and then we had to hit the ground running.
Your first meeting with her, what was your impression of her?
You know, I don't know that I've ever really talked to anybody about that. My initial impression was that Morgan had profound mental health needs that needed to be addressed very quickly.
When you see a situation like that, how do you approach the case?
Well, I'm not a mental health expert. I'm very good at realizing when I don't know something. So I could tell that there were mental health issues, but I didn't know how that affected what happened. So I hired doctors. I talked to the family and we got money together to bring in really top-notch doctors who could evaluate her and help us reach some conclusions.
And as you got that information, what was your goal with the case?
I had so many different goals as I went along in the case. I mean, my first goal is to keep her out of adult court because I couldn't believe that under Wisconsin law, an 11-year-old who just turned 12 could be prosecuted as an adult. It didn't dawn on me that that was something we did. And I know that sounds naive, right? I'm a lawyer. I should have reviewed the statutes years ago, but I don't know. I had never confronted a case where someone that a child that young was being prosecuted in an adult court. So initially I tried to keep her out of adult court. When that failed, when the judge disagreed with me, then we shifted focus to try to get her found not guilty as a result of her mental illness, which we were successful on.
Things have changed. She was put into a mental institution where she had help. Were you in contact with her during these years at all?
Yeah, throughout the whole time. So 12 years or so now.
And were you trying to get her out of that situation?
I was trying to make sure that she was healthy enough to be released from that situation. So my goal with Morgan always was, you know, I'm her attorney. I'm not her dad. I'm not her friend. So I always approached it as I have to give advice on what are the steps she should be taking to help achieve her release. And yeah, we were able to get it done eventually.
And you'd meet with her and your impression was?
My impression was she made progress over time. What I've come to learn is that, you know, I mean, my wife, before she worked for us, was a master educated social worker. She's brilliant. She has incredible knowledge of mental health. And she always told me that, you know, with youngsters in particular, you really have trouble diagnosing accurately what their conditions are. And that's true. What might look like schizophrenia might not be schizophrenia, or what might look like depression might be adolescent normal ups and downs. And so I learned over time that we needed to have the right doctors on board, and we did work with Morgan to encourage her to really open up in therapy and do the things she needed to do to secure her release.
So 3 months ago, you were able to do that.
Yeah. It was a very, very long road. I mean, in fact, there were times we filed the petition for her release, and then we actually pulled it back voluntarily on our own because I didn't feel that we were going to win. And if you're not going to win, there's no point in just putting it through that.
Did you have a conversation with her when you finally got the decision you wanted that, all right, Morgan, this is all on you. You got to watch yourself and be careful what you do.
Yes. I mean, it's exactly what we did. We talked about next steps and the fact that she's being released from an institution and going into the community. And specifically what I warned her about is I still don't think Morgan is a violent risk. I've been on record saying that. I mean, she did something very troubling and violent, obviously. But the risks that I see from Morgan is more that she hasn't learned how to navigate adult relationships in the way that you would if you grew up outside of the institution. That doesn't mean she shouldn't have been released. I mean, I still think that the judge made the right call. All the doctors supported it. But all the doctors that supported her release also recognized that there are going to be, and they would say it, men who are intrigued by her, who, for lack of a better word, fall into a category of being creepy and don't have her best interests in mind. And so she is going to have to learn how to rebuff those entreaties, if you will. And everybody always understood that that was going to be difficult for Morgan to do. I think time will show what the group home was like. I never visited her there. I had never been there, and I'd like to learn more about it.
Have you heard things that make you uncomfortable?
Just from what I know, that there was a man who was 43 and she's 25 who was able to have visits with her there and have contact with her there. And I'm just not sure that was healthy. I mean, obviously it wasn't healthy because she's found with him in Illinois.
How surprised were you when you heard that she had cut off her ankle bracelet and escaped?
I thought it was a joke. When I got the text from a lawyer who used to work for me, sent a screenshot of it, I thought there's no way this is a fake meme. And then I realized within minutes, because I started getting press calls, that in fact this was true. So, I mean, that whole Sunday, I was at like a nursery with my wife shopping for plants or something and Christmas ornaments. I'm getting call after call after call, and I didn't know what to say. I mean, my heart was broken because I couldn't imagine that Morgan would want to do something like that. And maybe she did, but I just felt like there's got to be some negative influence that led this to happen. And I still suspect that she was led in that direction.
Have you talked to her?
Yeah.
What'd she tell you that you can share?
I don't want to share a whole lot, but Morgan has said that she is looking forward to hopefully finding a different group home that she could be placed in that maybe would be more suitable for her needs.
What do you think the chances are that she's going to go in another group home in the near future?
I won't get into the specifics of it, but I mean, the judge has to make the decision about whether she is dangerous. And I'm glad that Morgan didn't do anything dangerous while she was out. Certainly she shouldn't have done this, but you know, she didn't commit a violent act. She wasn't aggressive towards the police officers. So it certainly could have been worse for her.
Has she been charged with anything?
No additional charges against her. And we're trying to get her transferred from the jail back to the mental hospital.
But will they look at this now that she's a potential flight risk and make it more difficult for you to get what you want, which is to put her in another group home?
This is going to make it more difficult for sure. And I think she's going to need to be evaluated probably some more, and there probably will have to be some more doctor opinions on her prognosis.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
People can say what they're going to say, but I did think, and I still do believe, that there was reasonable doubt for sure with respect to the homicide charge.
Defense attorney Anthony Cotton talks about the Maxwell Anderson case and if he had any regrets for defending him.
Yeah.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with defense attorney Anthony Cotton. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Looking at another case that you've had recently, this is a tough one, I'm sure. The Maxwell Anderson case.
Yeah.
How were you hired for that? Why did they reach out to you?
The father had a relationship with a judge, and the judge referred him to me.
When you heard the details of what he was charged with in the murder and dismemberment of Sade Robinson, what was your reaction? I mean, obviously you've been hired now to defend this guy, but this is a grisly case.
Grisly for sure. So, I mean, my first reaction was it's grisly. I think the same reaction everybody had. I felt a lot of empathy towards the victim's family. I felt a lot of empathy towards my client's family. I mean, he had two families that were ripped apart here, and one family had certainly lost their daughter, and the other family felt like they lost their son because he's in custody, and the case looks very bad for him. So that was my first reaction. Then I made a court appearance or two, and I remember, I think it was my first court appearance, I remember walking out, and I'm used to people recognizing me or they've seen me on the news or things like that, and they'll say hi. There was a woman who was standing there, just a regular person standing there with her phone out, but she had it up, like pointed at me. And I thought, I don't know, she's taking a picture of me or something. And she just started verbally assaulting me and saying horrible swear words and calling me names for what I was doing. How does it feel to defend such a sick person? And I still, to this day, I don't know who that person was, but it didn't stop. I mean, she followed me from the court appearance in intake court all the way through the courthouse, over the skywalk, into the safety building, up to the elevators, and continued to berate me even as I was waiting in the elevators. So, I mean, that made me realize that there was a level of vitriol out there and animosity and hatred that was going to persist throughout that case.
And you've had death threats.
Yeah. I mean, we were eating dinner one night as a family and police showed up at our front door. And, you know, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I tried to shield some of this from my wife. You know, it's just nothing I'd been through before. I didn't know how to handle it. But the police had showed up to our house and offered to escort my children to and from school. And the officer said, she showed her notebook and she goes, I got two addresses in this notebook. One is yours and one is the judge's. And they told me my job is to drive between the two houses and make sure everything's safe. And I assume that's what she did. I'm sure my neighbors were happy for more police presence in the neighborhood. That's never a bad thing. And we got into it. And that was, the death threats came through email, social media. Well, I disabled social media eventually, but, you know, phones.
How stressful is it when you're trying to defend somebody? You've been hired to do it. He has constitutional rights, whether people like it or not.
Yeah.
And yet you're facing this on a personal level.
It didn't affect my job, and I didn't really let it distract me from the work I had to do in court. I mean, anybody who had watched a trial would, I think, understand that we did what we thought we could do to defend the case with the evidence we had. It was a distraction, but you have lots of distractions in life. I hate to minimize it, but it's one of, in your day-to-day life, there just are distractions. There's cell phones. There's activities that you're involved with. There's things you're coaching or teaching. And so it was another thing that was out there, but not something that I dwelled on.
Were you surprised at all at the guilty verdict?
I was surprised at the speed of the guilty verdict. I was surprised that it came back without the jury taking the time to go through what I thought was a mountain of reasonable doubt. I talked earlier today about, you know, that concept of reasonable doubt and juries doing their job. And I'll stand by it. I mean, people can say what they're going to say, but I did think, and I still do believe, that there was reasonable doubt for sure with respect to the homicide charge. Certainly on an intentional homicide, there was no motive. There was no reason for him to do that. There was no DNA evidence within his home. There was no blood. There was no murder weapon, you know, and I've probably forgotten some of the details as time has gone by, but I could understand the guilty verdict on the arson. I mean, they had video of him walking away from the car as it's going up in flames, but I thought if they did reach a guilty verdict, it would be after days and days of deliberation. I really thought it would stretch over days because the prosecution had put on a mountain of material for them to look through.
After you've represented somebody like this, and obviously you fulfill your duty, you are doing everything you can to represent that client. When the jury said that they're guilty, and there doesn't seem to be any reasonable doubt at that point, how do you feel about the victim and their family and what they must have gone through?
It's horrible for them. That's probably the most common question that I get that question all the time. I mean, the things that the victim's mother has said about me online, I mean, nobody should say that about another person. I mean, she has dragged me through the mud every chance she's gotten. I haven't responded to any of it. I don't know what to say about that. As you said, I did the job that I was hired to do, and everybody has a constitutional right to a defense. I also understand and understood on day one just how horrific it is or would be to lose a child. So, I mean, I could hold both those things in my head at the same time. And I think that it's terrible what happened. Nobody should have to go through that. And I continue to feel sorrow for them.
Do you ever have second thoughts about doing it? About representing people who, it appears, they've committed these horrible acts?
No, it's what I signed up for, and it's my career. and I'm going to continue doing it.
Do you think of it more as a profession or a vocation?
My stepdad would have said if he were alive, he'd say it's a vocation. I'd say I see it more as a vocation. I think that's why I work so many hours. I think that's why I'm on call 24/7. I think that's why I take evening calls, because I just live it.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
My firm handles those, but other lawyers do it. I don't handle that. I think there's just certain things I know that I'm good at and that I'm capable of doing, and certain things that I don't want to be involved with.
Defense attorney Anthony Cotton reveals if there's anyone he would refuse to defend.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with defense attorney Anthony Cotton. Are there any cases that you say, no, I'm not going to go there?
Yeah, plenty. Yep. I reject probably 70% of the calls that come into our firm.
So what is it that makes you say, I want to represent this individual?
Usually I rule out who I don't want to represent. So
who would that be?
It's people that I don't like when they call. It's people who call and they're offensive over the phone, or they're discourteous, or they start screaming at you, about the fees that you want to quote for the case. Or it's somebody who calls you up and they've hired 5 previous lawyers, and every one of their lawyers they say is an idiot. And you think to yourself, why would I, as number 6, why would you treat me any better than you've treated the previous 5? So, and then there's, for me, like child sexual assault cases, like my firm handles those, but other lawyers do it. I don't handle that. I think there's just certain things I know that I'm good at and that I'm capable of doing, and certain things that I don't want to be involved with. And so therefore I reject the cases.
You mentioned the fees, and obviously defense attorneys charge a lot of money. Do you ever take cases pro bono?
I do. Yep.
What makes you want to take on those?
Well, I was raised that way. So that was part of my mom and stepdad had always done that. And so I've just continued that legacy. It's hard to say what it is that makes you do one. I mean, certainly I wouldn't want to take a case like Maxwell Anderson pro bono, and you couldn't. I mean, it's so taxing on your firm and just the paralegal expenses and the time commitment. So it tends to be cases that, where it just hits me that this is the right thing to do. I'll give you an example. I pray to God this doesn't result in hundreds of letters coming in. But like, I had a guy in the jail who wrote me a letter, and I get lots of letters from the jail. But this particular, and I read every letter I get and I respond to every letter. But, I was in on a Saturday. I got a letter from a client at the jail, or an inmate at the jail. It was a murder case. And I was persuaded from the letter that he was innocent. And I'm usually not persuaded. I get a lot of I'm innocent letters. But I said, okay, I'm going to go meet him. I went and met him. And I grilled him about all the things that I thought were problems in his case. And he had a very good answer for every single potential problem with the case. I mean, I was certain as I could be, that he was wrongly accused of murder. So I agreed to take that case as a pro bono, even though it was a huge time commitment. We didn't win. We got a hung jury, actually, 6-6. So he had to be retried down the road. But that was just one that I was convinced he needed my help.
Are there ever any cases that you look back with and say, I wish I hadn't taken that?
Nothing that really comes to mind. I mean, I think I've learned something from every case I've taken on. There's ones that I look back on. I can think of one in particular that actually, believe it or not, way back in the day, we're talking like 2007, they used to do these sting operations. And they would find men online who were trying to chat with underage girls. But it would be a detective that was impersonating a child, and they would ensnare these guys in these sting operations. And Waukesha County did a big one that actually a journalist who works at AM 620 was the lead reporter on that case way back then. And I remember with that case, I remember thinking at the time, like, I shouldn't have taken that one on, because there was hostility with the client. He was firing me and telling me I don't know what I'm doing. I had John Mercure from AM 620 jamming a camera in my face and throwing questions at me, and I love him now, but I didn't love him then. And so it was just one of those cases where I felt like, and the client was threatening me at the time, and he's going to kill me, and he's going to get out and find me. And, that would be the one example I could think of a case that I didn't enjoy at the time.
You're still fairly young. You're what?
45.
45. Okay. So you got a long road ahead of you in terms of career. Do you ever think you're going to walk away from being a criminal defense attorney and do something else?
Yes. I think I would practice law 15 more years, 10 to 15 more years of full-time criminal defense work. But I would like to. I think 30 years in any profession is enough time in any given profession. So, I'm 20 years into it now. Maybe I'll evaluate it when I'm older, of course. But I could see myself teaching. I currently teach in a local high school. I coach youth sports. So I could see myself being an educator. I would like that. I would like to teach kids.
You have kids yourself.
Yeah.
Would you want them to do what you're doing?
I take the same approach with them that my – so the, what I hear from almost every lawyer, believe it or not, is – and some are joking, but most aren't. They all say they hate it. You know, never want their kids to do it. My friends make these remarks all the time. They say things like, you know, another day, you know, how's life? Taken forever, you know, just trudging along. And I think it's joking, but, you know, your words become your actions and your thoughts. And so my parents always took the position of it's a very good career if you want to pursue it, but that's on you if you want to. And my dad always said, my dad who owned the garbage company, he always said, they'll never take it away from you. It's always the expression he used. They'll never take it away from you. And I thought, that's right. You know, if I have a law degree, I'll have it for life. And if I choose to be a journalist or a reporter or a politician, like, I'll have a law degree. And I would tell my kids the same thing. Like, they'll never take it away from you. And if it's something, I think my older son is very interested in it. If it's something he wants to do or both of them want to do, I would support it 100%.
Anthony Cotton, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with defense attorney Anthony Cotton. He's the man who's defended Morgan Geiser, who is known for the Slender Man case. He also defended Maxwell Anderson, who was convicted of killing and dismembering Sade Robinson. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Anthony, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.